From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for AlMonitor.com. Joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. And here are the issues. The head of a moderate Syrian opposition group came to Washington and appealed for anti-aircraft weapons to try to change the calculus of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. But the U.S. government offered mostly symbolic gestures as rebel fighters withdrew from one of their last original strongholds, Homs, under a ceasefire brokered by Iran and the United Nations. Russian President Vladimir Putin said he'd ordered Russian forces back from the border with Ukraine, but U.S. and NATO officials said they detected no pullback, while bloody clashes continued between pro-Russian separatists and supporters of the Kiev government. The Obama administration sent U.S. military advisors to Nigeria to help the Nigerian government find more than 200 schoolgirls abducted several weeks ago by Boko Haram, a militant Islamic group. And finally, here in the United States, a new report on climate change shows what anyone living here should already know, that there have been serious consequences for much of the country caused by an average increase in temperatures of less than 2 degrees Fahrenheit. Without major steps by carbon-emitting countries, including China and the United States, temperatures could soar by 10 degrees by the end of the century, leading to more floods, droughts, and other calamities of biblical proportions. Gentlemen, let's start with Syria for a change. We usually start with Ukraine, but we're going to start with Syria. This is what a senior U.S. official told reporters on background as the head of the Syrian opposition coalition, Ahmed Jarba, was arriving in Washington. Quote, "The current conditions, the current asymmetry, does not provide the kind of political calculus needed to get that type of negotiated, serious political process underway." Okay, that's Washington speak, David. What is this man telling us, and what does it mean for the Syrian opposition coalition and its leader, Ahmed Jarba?
Well, if you're a cynic or a pessimist, it sounds a lot like Assad is winning, and we don't know what to do about that, or we don't have any desire to do very much about that. And these are the same senior officials who a year ago explained that they weren't going to do anything because this was a stalemate, and that the forces were evenly balanced on both sides, and that they just wanted to nudge without actually trying to impose regime change or bring victory to the rebel side, because the stalemate was inevitably going to end in a negotiated settlement. I think one of the most depressing things about the last 18 months, I mean, of course, the most depressing thing is the human suffering and catastrophic loss of life. But one of the other depressing things about the debate in Washington is, if you go back to the beginning of this crisis, you had the camp saying, we should do nothing, it's unfixable. You had the camp saying, we need to try and arm the moderate rebels, try and intervene. It is now, utterly predictably, so much worse, so much more horrible. So many lives have been lost. And that comforts both sides in their pre-existing prejudice. Both sides say, you see, we told you so. And the political stalemate here is as absolute as ever.
Tom, you know, this is a classic chicken and egg sort of situation. The Syrian Opposition Coalition used to be called the Syrian National Coalition. U.S. recognized it as the legitimate representative of the Syrian people back in December 2012. But since then, its fortunes don't seem to have improved very much. And, you know, the opponents of giving them support say, well, they have no traction on the ground. But if you don't give them support, they get no traction on the ground. And the only way to empower them is to give them more weapons. Congress, the administration obviously are nervous about these so-called man pads, the shoulder-fired missiles, anti-aircraft missiles that the opposition desperately wants. But without those, they are completely vulnerable to terrible bombardment from Syrian government forces, barrel bombs and Scud missiles and whatnot. So right. How do you get out of this sort of chicken and egg situation?
I don't think you get out of it, because I think President Obama is very dead set against a more robust intervention in Syria. There is no political imperative at the moment. I think President Obama came in pledging to end the war in Afghanistan. He's doing that. He has a demonstrated bias against unilateral intervention. And in this case, he was not really able to get the British and the French and other Western allies.
You got the French, not the British.
For a while, that's right. The French looked pretty good on this one. That's exactly right. But he was not able to get concerted European support, and so he pulled back. I mean, we all remember where he drew a red line, and he said, "My red line will be if Syria has weapons of mass destruction." Well, it became clear that they did, and they still do. And the White House allowed the Russians to broker a deal for Syria to remove those weapons, which they're doing, but very, very slowly. And so I think it's a mess, and the White House, the Obama administration, puts its head in its hands and doesn't know what to do, so they don't do anything.
Well, they do something, David. I mean, they announced, another $27 million in non-lethal aid. I love that expression.
It tends to be these ready meals that soldiers get given that are just before their expiry date, seems to be some of the
bulk
of
what we're sending. And trucks and radios. I mean, there are some real things.
The truth is, I think, that when history looks back at this really horrible moment, the Syrian people, it is their misfortune to have their suffering happening at the end of a decade of war in this country. That's what's going on, is that President Obama, let's not, you know, here in Washington, there is a foreign policy establishment, which, you know, I would probably endorse, which, you know, wrings its hands and wants more to be done. But you go outside the beltway, you go into the rest of America, and people are on Obama's side. You know, there is an absolute belief in this country that this country spent a lot of blood and treasure on an ungrateful, unfixable world. And although you won't hear it said explicitly, except by sort of the most sort of extreme voices, most people think that the Muslim world, this is what these people are like. Muslims kill Muslims. They're fanatics. We have no business trying to sort them out. That's not what I believe. It's not what you believe. But that's what an awful lot of people have concluded after, you know, spending unbelievable amounts of money and too many lives in Iraq and Afghanistan. And now Iraq and Afghanistan look like a mess. Iraq is an unfriendly government that is closer to Iran than it is to America. And Afghanistan, when final American troops leave, the bulk of them will leave this year, and it will feel like a defeat. Yeah. And the Taliban will be part of the mix. So in that mood, the Syrian people who are dying and suffering horribly, their timing is off. They're a decade late.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I mean, one of the problems, of course, is the nature of the opposition. It started as a nonviolent protest, and then it rapidly changed character, became violent, and attracted foreign jihadis, all sorts of unsavory people. Ahmed Jarba, the head of the Syrian opposition coalition, he's from the north of Syria. It was his debut in Washington. I must say, I was really underwhelmed. He spoke at the U.S. Institute of Peace. He did not even have a prepared speech. He just spoke extemporaneously. He's not a very powerful speaker. I expected somehow more, something more charismatic from him. And I was wondering at the choice of this man to head the coalition. Apparently, Tom, it's because the Saudis like him. He's a member of a tribe, the Shamar tribe, which has branches in Iraq and Saudi Arabia. He's a Sunni Muslim. And this was why he was chosen. But if you want to make an impression, even if you want to sort of touch the heartstrings of Americans, strikes me you need a somewhat more charismatic figure than Ahmed Jarba.
You need somebody that average Americans would feel like is worth investing in. And yeah. I think he did not feel, sound, or look like a good investment, just to put it bluntly. But again, beyond the macro reason, which is, as David says, the war weariness after a decade of all of this in this country, the other major factor is, I think, the Obama administration and especially the CIA are deathly afraid that these shoulder-fired missiles that could knock down Assad's helicopters and fighter jets will somehow find their way into the inventory of al-Qaeda, and that the CIA seems to be convinced that there's no way to keep that from happening. And I think that's the smaller but important piece of the larger issue.
Mm-hmm. David, one other tack. The U.S. apparently will support a call to refer Syria to the International Criminal Court. There's been some action at the U.N. I believe a resolution has been drafted by the French. But, of course, they're the Russians.
And the Chinese behind them.
Have a veto.
A second veto vote. The oddest thing about America's policy, which we're going to see with kind of painful clarity now, because, you know, we assume this ICC track will not resolve this problem. Let's not forget that America's extreme timidity sort of on the ground is matched, oddly, with an extremely bold sort of starting point, which is the American government has said that Assad has no place in the future government of Syria. So they began with the biggest sort of decision of all, which was that Assad should go. They've since done absolutely nothing to bring that about. If the analysts that I've been talking to recently from various governments say Assad is winning, mm-hmm. does there come a point quite soon where the American government, which had said trenchantly that Assad had to go and he's illegitimate, Assad will stage this election.
Yeah, in June he's going to run for another seven-year term.
Which, you know, he will make sure he wins, handily, and then he will say, look, I've got a fresh mandate, I'm not going anywhere. You know, let's talk again about this I've got to go policy, because you don't seem to be doing very much about this. And I don't know what America's sort of options are at that point. But I don't know where we go from here.
Well, I presume we just continue giving humanitarian aid. I mean, it should be said that the U.S. is giving more humanitarian aid to Syrian refugees, displaced Syrian, than any other country. So it's dealing with the consequences, containing the consequences, rather than trying to go to the root cause.
One thing we haven't discussed is what you do hear from diplomats and officials in this town is that over the last couple of months, there has been, so far unsuccessfully, a big push from some in the State Department, including the Secretary of State, John Kerry, to see a big ramping up of the training of rebel fighters. Currently a covert program run by the CIA in Jordan, but he would like to see this become perhaps an open program and the sort of flow vastly increase. You know, this has certainly been, you know, at least a month or two ago, John Kerry had not given up on that track. And some people said that you could see hints of movement in the Pentagon. Let's not forget the military has been very fiercely opposed to doing very much about this.
Yeah, in fact, the senior administration official who briefed us on the Jarba visit suggested that this was the most hotly debated topic in Washington now. So Ahmed Jarba is in town for a total of about 10 days and is due to meet with President Obama. So we will see. Perhaps they will covertly provide some of the support that overtly they don't want to provide. Let's take a pause here for a second. We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder, you're listening to Issues in the News coming to you on The Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of AlMonitor.com. Joining me today are David Rennie of The Economist and Tom DeFrank of National Journal. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com. Tom, let's turn to another seemingly intractable problem, and that is that of Ukraine and Russia. Vladimir Putin has flown to Crimea to celebrate Russia's victory over Nazi Germany. How do you think Vladimir Putin is feeling about the situation in Ukraine these days?
Well, he keeps offering these contradictory developments. In the last few days, he has asked the pro-Russian militants, sympathizers, whatever you want to call them, in eastern Ukraine to delay their referendum, which would almost certainly, if it happened, would determine that eastern Ukraine would like to be associated with Russia. And he also has said he's pulling back those 40,000 Russian troops on the border of Ukraine in the east. Now, of course, in this day and age, there are satellites, and the satellites see everything, unless the weather is bad and there are too many clouds. And U.S. intelligence and Western intelligence has said he's not moving those troops. He's just saying he's moving those troops. So it's murky, and it's not clear what is going to happen now. You get the feeling that Putin does not want to invade Ukraine proper. That would cause him all sorts of bigger problems. And I think he doesn't want a lot more sanctions, and the West is going to impose a third level of sanctions if, in fact, he does send troops across the border. So it's in a state of flux, and it's in a state of, it's just unclear what's happening now. But I think Putin is still having a lot of fun from his standpoint.
Having a lot of fun, David?
Well, I hope that he's slightly more concerned than that. I mean, I think clearly, you know, going to Crimea for him is a sort of, you know, is a mini victory tour. But I think that there are two explanations for what we saw in the last few days. So what we saw was the most conciliatory, or at least moderated, sort of language we've seen from President Putin, saying that he, as Tom said, you know, he was going to pull these troops back. He was calming down on the referendum. There are two obvious explanations for why he's doing that. One is, it's a cynical kind of judo move. He's trying to split the West, which, because the people who don't want to confront him in the West will say, you see, we shouldn't be confronting him. And he's leaving Ukraine sort of guessing as ever and sowing dissension. The other explanation is that he genuinely felt that events were running a bit out of control, a bit ahead of himself, and he doesn't want to have to insert Russian forces under Russian cap badges and Russian shoulder patches overtly into what looks increasingly at some moments like a civil war. I mean, we saw, you know, really nasty violence and larger and larger numbers of people being killed. The problem from the outside is both those explanations would produce the Putin we can see. So we won't know for a while which it is. It's either in charge, knows what he's doing, cunning judo Putin, which would look like this, or it's slightly panicked, trying to rein it in and buy himself a bit more sort of breathing room Putin, which would look like this. So we're in some slightly strange moment. But Tom is absolutely right. I mean, you saw quite a strong statement from the head of NATO, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, saying, you know, I have exceptionally good eyesight, but I can tell you I have seen no movement whatsoever of troops away from this border, despite all the statements.
Yeah, now, as we're speaking, it's not clear whether the pro-Russian separatists are going to go ahead with a quote-unquote referendum on autonomy for, I think, what they're calling the People's Republic of Donetsk. It does seem clear, Tom, from the polls that have been conducted, that any fair and legitimate referendum would not necessarily give a majority, even in eastern Ukraine, to pro-autonomy or pro-Russia forces.
Well, I think that's right. It's a very murky situation. It's hard to believe that these pro-Russian paramilitary or quasi-military or secret or special forces, whatever you want to call them, it's hard to believe that they're not taking their cues from Moscow, and it's hard to believe that they are defying Putin and insisting that this referendum go forward. If Putin didn't want it to go forward, I think it would not go forward. I mean, I think these forces are basically working for the Kremlin, and it defies credibility to believe otherwise, and very few Western analysts believe that. So,
yeah. One key test is going to be whether Ukraine proper can have an election on May 25th for president. And
that's only the first test. I mean, I think it's worth explaining. Why are we seeing so much sort of, you know, in what looks like a war zone, we're having all these conversations about constitutional structures and regional governments and autonomy and constitution. Let's be clear what that means. It's not, as far as we can tell, that Moscow is planning to annex and absorb great chunks of eastern Ukraine. But when the Russians say that they would support a much looser federal structure, what they basically want is a weak Ukraine where the central government does not have the ability to set its own foreign policy. I don't think Ukraine was ever likely to join NATO. They'd always said at the beginning that they fancied the EU more than NATO, partly because they have gigantic Russian arms industries in Ukraine, and half the country wouldn't want to go. Frankly, the truth is the EU is not about to admit Ukraine. I mean, it's just not going to happen. But growing close to the West, signing agreements with the West, you know, falling under the sphere of the West, Putin's aim is to have a loose kind of patchwork Ukraine where individual regions which are pro-Russian get to veto the future foreign policy of the central government. So a weak, destabilized central government, and then political parties which Russia can fund behind the scenes, oligarchs who Russia can favor, and Russia can be the puppet master behind the scenes without the bore of having to run Ukraine as a colony.
Yeah, that's a perfect segue into our next topic, which is another country that is having some considerable problems with its various regions, and that's Nigeria. Tom, this story has really captivated, horrified people around the world, and that is the abduction of these young girls in Nigeria by Boko Haram. It's become even a social media phenomenon. There's a Twitter hashtag, Bring Back Our Girls, and Michelle Obama tweeted it and had a picture taken of herself holding this hashtag in her hands. What is Nigeria doing to get back these young women? It's been weeks now. Is it almost too late to save them?
Well, let's hope it's not too late to save them, but I think Nigeria is doing next to nothing. It's pretty clear now that for all of Nigeria's oil wealth, it's got a pretty pathetic military that, according to Western analysts, the Nigerian military cannot even launch a credible rescue operation. The U.S. Has now sent a very sophisticated team, including FBI agents and others, humanitarian experts, logistics experts, to try to help the Nigerian government do something. But I just think the Nigerian government is weak, feckless, corrupt, and doesn't know what to do. It is such an indictment of a country that it cannot protect even the young teenage girls from these lunatics. And the leader of this group has now been on social media bragging about it. And this is one that it just defies belief that at this point in civilization that these things can still happen. And at the moment, at least in Nigeria, it can happen with impunity so far. Let's hope that changes.
David, U.S. Navy Rear Admiral John Kirby, the Pentagon press secretary, has said that they believe that the girls have been split up into smaller groups, and there's concern that they've already been taken out of Nigeria into neighboring countries. Is it possible to get them back? Is it possible to direct a drone strike against the leader of Boko Haram, Abu Bakr Shekau? How do you think this is going to evolve?
You know, I'm glad that people are upset by this horrible thing, but it's also nauseating because actually we in the West, in America, in Britain, we're talking a big game. We intend doing nothing. We will do nothing. Mm-hmm. The Nigerian government wouldn't permit a military operation. There isn't going to be a military operation. It's probably impossible. They probably have been separated. This sort of social media hashtag, bring back our girls. We're in a political climate where if you tried getting 270 Nigerian refugees visas to live in our country, we'd probably say no. I mean, there is a tremendous amount of hypocrisy and kind of sentimental nonsense, and by next week it'll be forgotten. It's just this week's fat. I'm afraid I'm completely...
I disagree with you there.
Completely cynical about this.
Yeah, I disagree with you there. I think, you know, you pointed out earlier when we were talking about Syria that Americans have this image of Muslims as people who fight each other and don't really care. But this is the sort of thing that any parent, I think, can identify with. And we've seen also the domestic political ramifications in Nigeria. Mentioned that there's a meeting of the World Economic Forum that was taking place in Abuja, in the Nigerian capital, and there have been massive protests outside by Nigerians saying, you know, why are you having this ridiculous international conference when you can't even protect our children?
I'm not saying that it's not an appalling event and that it's not hugely symbolic of just how badly wrong Nigeria is going. And Nigeria is a very large, very populous, important country. I'm not saying that. I'm just sitting in Washington saying that the Washington reaction is a flash in the pan. And the single greatest excitement yesterday in Washington was an article which correctly noted that under Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, the State Department chose, largely to avoid a rift with the Nigerian government, chose not to list Boko Haram as a foreign terrorist organization. So Republicans were weighing in because it's a great way of damaging Hillary Clinton if she tries to make a run for the White House. Now that's a way of getting people's attention in Washington. If you can make it about domestic politics and tearing down someone in advance of the next presidential election, now you've got yourself a story.
Well, let's make it about domestic politics. Let's talk about climate change, Tom, which is not something we usually talk about on this program. But as anyone who has lived on the East Coast of the United States can attest, we had a horrible winter, freakishly cold, many snowstorms, now many rainstorms of a magnitude that we don't normally see at this time of the year. The White House released its third climate assessment. Will this change anybody's minds about the reality of climate change?
Well, I'd like to believe it would, but I think the majority of Americans believe that climate change is real, but there is a very vigorous minority that says it's just all baloney, it's just a liberal plot to bring the energy industry to its knees. I think you have to be blind, deaf, and dumb not to stipulate that something is going on. One of the fascinating and sobering figures in this report said that unless carbon emissions are reduced over the next 10 years, that by the middle of this century, the East Coast of this country, of the United States, we'll see 60 more days of temperatures higher than 90 degrees Fahrenheit. And it's pretty, 60 days. That's 16% more horrifically hot and humid days. You don't have to like the politics of the environmental movement. You can call them extremists if you want to, but something is going on, and it's hard to believe that it is not interrelated.
Yeah. David, President Obama went to the West Coast to raise money for Democratic candidates in the midterm elections, but also to announce some measures on more investment in solar energy, that sort of thing. Do you think this latest report, which had a map that actually showed precipitation increases in temperatures and so on, do you think this is going to have an impact?
I'm afraid I think that it should do, but adding new data into this debate is not what's needed. There's already, you know, unbelievable amounts of scientific data. This is a culture war being fought with scientific kind of data as the weapons, but not meaningfully. I think, you know, ultimately, when I talk to sort of American voters, and let's look at the opinion polls, most Republican voters do not believe in man-made climate change. A majority of Republican voters do not believe in man-made climate change. Why is that? Is that because they're climate scientists? No. Is it, do Democrats believe in it because they're climate scientists? No. It's because when you have a very complex, data-filled scientific question like this, people tend to fall back on their gut instincts. And the gut instincts of conservatives is that this is a plot, as Tom says, by people who've always hated big cars and gas guzzlers. It's the latest way of getting them out of their big cars and denying them their...
Well, we should point out that many Republicans don't believe in evolution. But Tom, I believe you wanted another one.
Very quick random anecdote. 3 years ago, I was on a cruise ship that went to Antarctica, and we saw these giant icebergs that had broken off from the ice pack, and these giant icebergs had thousands of penguins living on them. And we had a couple of experts who actually live and work in Antarctica come onto the ship, and they said, all I can tell you is we've never seen these sorts of pieces of ice break off like this. We've been working here for 20 years, and the polar ice caps are melting. The U.S. government says that in 5 years there's going to be hundreds of square miles of near the North Pole of navigable ocean, and the Navy's got to figure out how to operate in that. So it's, as I said, you've really got to have a kind of a hole in your head to deny that something is going on here.
We appreciate that. I think people who are living in coastal areas also are well aware of the rising sea levels that are coming from that melting. But that's all the time we have this week. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for AlMonitor.com. Thanks for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.